Trust that by the end of our service this morning, you'll go out with a renewed sense of confidence. This is what we believe as Christians. This is what I want to share with people around me. This is how I want to engage in the workplace in this coming week. So here's Paul writing. He says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. Paul goes on to write, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have clearly been seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men and women are without excuse. Now we begin a new series this morning, which we've entitled Experiencing God, engaging with the God, or enlarging your vision of the God that we serve and worship. It's a very exciting series, because I trust, and certainly my prayer is, that as we move through this series on Sunday mornings, your vision of God will be renewed, your understanding of the greatness of God will be challenged and expanded. And we begin this morning with a very timely question of the existence of God. It's particularly timely because if you've been reading the papers over this weekend, or you've listened to any radio or perhaps television debate, you'll know that the debate that's going on this week is, did God in fact create our world or not? A new book hits the shops this week. It's entitled The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking. And in it he's going to argue that in fact, God did not create the universe. I think in the Daily Mail, somebody was telling me before the service this morning, there was a very good article by John Lennox. I'm going to refer to John's book in just a moment. But there's a lot of debate going on. This book has stirred a lot of discussion. And as you go out into a new week, I want to try and equip you in some way, some small way this morning, to engage in this timely debate. It's interesting that these things coincide. In terms of the subject that we're looking at this morning and the publication of this book, I didn't plan it to be like that this morning. But that's how God is speaking to us from his word. And in this book, and without going into the argument because we haven't got time this morning, and you'd probably get pretty bored if I was to try to expand all of his argument, essentially what Stephen Hawking is arguing, he's saying because there are physical laws that exist, and in particular because there's a law such as gravity, he's going to argue in this book that the universe can and will create itself from nothing. That's the sort of line of his argument. But one of the things that you'll hear in the debates, if you've been listening to any of them over the weekend, and particularly from Christians who are engaging in this debate, is that Hawking still fails to answer the question of where do these laws of physics come from in the first place? How come there is something rather than nothing? And despite the hype and the controversy that this book is causing, Hawking still can't explain that something came out of nothing. And for that matter, how do the laws of gravity and the laws of physics exist in the first place? And for those of you who enjoy a good read and you really want to get into this debate, this is a great book which has just been updated by John Lennox. He's the guy who wrote the article in the Daily Mail yesterday morning. God's Undertaker. It's a wonderful engagement of Christianity versus religion. It's an excellent book. It's a great read. And I want to recommend it to you this morning. But the question I want us to think about as we move into this new series is how are you and I going to engage? This is a God-given opportunity for us to speak this week, if you haven't had the opportunity already. Because people are talking about this book. It's not even a new idea that Stephen Hawking is actually promoting. It's actually an old idea which has just been reworked. But when you engage with people in this coming week about the existence of God, I wonder what you will say as a Christian. Maybe you sort of feel, well, actually, you know what, we're not really equipped to deal with this. I can't really argue into this situation. What can you do? What can you say? Let me start with a story this morning. It's a story that probably has taken place in lots of classrooms, even during this past week, as many of you headed back to school. Some of you as teachers, but lots of our children have headed back to school in this past week. It's a story about some primary school children. A teacher said to the children, he says, we're going to do a painting this morning, and I want you to paint something that you've been doing over the summer period. Just paint us a picture of what you've been up to. The primary teacher watched as the children put on their little plastic aprons, and they started to paint. And she began to sort of walk around the classroom, looking over the shoulder of some of the children to see how they were getting on. And some were painting pictures of their parents, and some were painting pictures of the seaside, and some were painting pictures of the animals following a visit to the zoo. And then the teacher stopped over this particularly shapeless and colourful painting. "What a lovely painting, Scott," she said. She said, "What is it?" "Oh," replied Scott, "that's a picture of God." "But no one's ever seen God," replied the teacher. And this little boy looked up with his eyes open wide, and he replied to his teacher, "Well, now they have Miss." It's lovely, isn't it? And it's not only small children who paint pictures of God. It's something that human beings have been doing since the beginning of time. There have been gods in the shape of animals. There have been gods in the shape of fire and water. People have looked up at the heavens and they've seen God in the shape of stars and the sun. And there have been gods who are distant and remote. And there have been gods who are fearsome and close. And the question that we're going to look at together this morning is a question that you may well be asked in this coming week. How, as a Christian, can you show me that God, your God, exists? Can you prove it to me? What can you say to me in terms of the discussion that's going on at the moment? How can you be sure? How do we know that we're just not alone in this world in which we live? Is there really something or someone behind it all? The Apostle Paul, in a sense, answers that question for us in general terms, that passage that we've just looked at in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. He puts it like this. He says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, from what has been created." And then he ends with these words, "so we are without excuse." And what's Paul doing in that passage? Well, Paul is pointing us, if you like, to some of God's divine fingerprints in the created world in which we live. Now, we haven't time to look at all of those divine fingerprints this morning, so I single out five that I think could help us as we go out into a new week, and as perhaps we engage in discussion which will inevitably come as this book is published this week. So here are five divine fingerprints. You might want to jot these down as we go through them. Firstly, what sometimes is referred to as the mysterious Big Bang. In other words, how come there is something rather than nothing? It's interesting that a few years ago, Stephen Hawking wrote these words. He says, "Almost everyone now believes that the universe and the time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. The fact that there is something rather than nothing leaves us with two possibilities this morning. Either you believe this morning that, as Stephen Hawking is trying to argue in this new book, that something or someone, that our universe rather just came into being, that somehow or other there was an inevitability about it because of the laws of physics, that our world just sort of came together. Just happened. Or you're left with the alternative that someone outside of our universe made it and ordered it, and the fact that there is something rather than nothing leads us at least to consider the possibility that a creator God exists. That's a very provocative clue for a lot of people. A divine fingerprint that there is something rather than nothing. Jot that down and take it with you into this week. Here's another divine fingerprint that you might get into discussion about. The complexity of our universe, the natural world in which we live and have been singing about this morning. Our God is a great big God. We've been singing about some of the created world. We live in a stunningly complex and beautiful world. It is intricately and finely balanced. Sir James Jean, the famous Jean's a British astronomer, once put it like this in describing the world in which we live and the universe. He says, "The universe appears to have been designed by a pure mathematician. For him, the order of the earth, the solar system, the universe points us in the direction of a master planner." I'm sure that you know some of these incredible statistics about the world in which we live. That the earth on which you and I are sitting on at the moment is tilted at an angle of exactly 23 degrees. That finely tuned balance produces our seasons. If the angle were any different, even by a half of a degree, life on our planet would be unsustainable. The vapors from the oceans would move north and south, and the Earth would gradually become encased by an ice cap. That's how finely tuned the world in which we live has been constructed. Someone has calculated that if the crust of the earth, the depth of the earth, or the crust of the earth was just 10 feet thicker, there would be no oxygen and all life would cease to exist. The weight of the earth, and I have no idea how anybody calculates something like this, it's been calculated to be in the region of 6 sextillion tons. Now that's 6 followed by 23 zeros. That's a pretty big number. It rotates at 1,000 miles an hour. It travels about 25,000 miles a day, which is about 9 million miles in a year. And that's why some of us feel a bit tired at the end of the day. We've travelled a long way, whether you realise it or not. That's how finely tuned our world is. I need to ask you this morning, does it make sense to suggest that this could just have happened? As Hawking suggested in his new book, that the universe has created itself from nothing. I want to suggest to you, this is a very powerful divine fingerprint that points us in the direction of a creator God. The third divine fingerprint that I would highlight this morning is the fingerprint of our personalities. The very fact of the existence of our personalities. Hawking, in his book, and many other critics of religion, want us to believe that we are nothing but a random collection of molecules. We're kind of a byproduct of a random explosion that took place millions of years ago. Here's how one scientist has described human beings. It's not very flattering. He says, "You and I are nothing but a complex biochemical mechanism powered by a combustion system which energizes computers with prodigious storage facilities for retaining encoded information." Does that make you feel better about yourself this morning? But you see, if that is true, then it undermines the very rationality that we need to study science in the first place. If we're just a collection of molecules and colliding atoms, we know from what we've discovered about ourselves that human beings are the most amazing and profound of all that has been created. We have self-consciousness. We are able to love, we're able to hate, we're able to feel, we're able to make decisions. We have appetites, we have desires. St. Augustine, one of the early church fathers, reasons that these desires are in fact clues to the reality of God. And the existence of personality, I want to suggest to you this morning, is another one of God's divine fingerprints that points us in the direction of a creator God. So as you and I move out into a week where this debate is very live and very real, I encourage you to take some of these fingerprints with you. Why is there something rather than nothing? Let's move into fingerprint number four, the existence of morality. You see, we have to at least ask the question this morning, why is it that all human beings have some kind of inbuilt understanding of the concepts of right and wrong? Where does that sense of morality come from? We may not always agree as you travel across the world from country to country as to the absolutes of what is right and what is wrong, but there is a general consensus very often, and we know that right and wrong exist. You only have to have young children to see how very quickly right and wrong begins to develop in their minds. It goes from the youngest child through to the most complex ethical debates within our society. Where does that deep-seated consciousness come from? Could it be, for example, that behind the laws of right and wrong there exists the lawgiver? Or as somebody has put it, that our mental software has some kind of programmer. Morality. The existence of morality. A divine fingerprint that points us towards the existence of a creator God. But for me, this fifth clue is probably one of the most powerful, and it particularly speaks into the generation in which we live today, this hunger and thirst for something more. That's one of the reasons why we do this series on Ecclesiastes on Sunday nights, because it's going to address some of the big questions that people are asking today. Is life just meaningless and purposeless, or is there something more to it? It seems that no matter what culture you enter, or whatever period of history you study, people have always had a religious dimension to their lives. It's as if deep down, we have an awareness of another reality, that there is more to life than we can touch and feel and see around us, which cannot be explained by the laws of science. But people seem to have a thirst for something that can't be satisfied by the things of this world. Michael Vaughan comments in his book Turning Points. He says, "We're surrounded by people who suffer from what has been called Marie Antoinette's disease, because she was the one who first coined this phrase, nothing tastes." I'm sure you may well have had conversations with people that you rub shoulders with, that deep down, what is it all about? What is the sense of purpose about the world in which we live? There must be more to it. Something that gives us a sense of meaning and purpose to life. I've often referred to these wonderful words from Augustine, and I have found no better quotation. He puts it like this. He says, God, this is part of his own personal discovery. God, he says, you have made us for yourself. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. Could it be then that this thirst for something more suggests that we are built for a relationship with our Creator God who exists? Here are five divine fingerprints this morning that you could take with you into this new week. As people sort of talk about this book, and as you read some of the articles that are being written about Stephen Hawking, and as you read some of the responses that are being made by people like John Lennox, who's a very able Christian writer, try some of these divine fingerprints in your discussions with people. Say, well, how do you explain some of these things? How come there's something rather than nothing? Look at the complexity of our universe. If our Earth was just a half a degree out, there would be no life sustainable on this planet. How do you describe the existence of personality? How do you describe the existence, how do you explain the existence of personality and of morality? And what about this thirst for something more that so many people have today? Tim Keller, in his recent book entitled The Reason for God, suggests, and you'd be glad that I haven't gone down this street this morning, that there are 2 to 3 dozen very good arguments for the existence of God. We'd be here for a long time if we took all of those this morning. But I'm saying that to you this morning because I want you to be more confident about what we believe as Christians. 2 to 3 dozen good arguments for the existence of God, written by a Christian author who really has a handle on so many of these things. But there is, however, a much more compelling argument for the existence of God, and it is based on our convictions as Christian people. Convictions that were written in the Bible that you have in front of you this morning. They wanted to keep a record of the extraordinary events that surrounded the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And those convictions and beliefs point us beyond these divine fingerprints and show us clearly that there is a God who exists and can be known. So we looked at 5 divine fingerprints this morning, or rather divine fingerprints this morning. But I want to take you to 4 Christian convictions. My prayer is that as we go into this new week, we'll be more confident in terms of what we believe, more confident to be able to engage with people around us. And I want to take you to these Christian convictions because this is what we believe as Christian people this morning. Here's the first one. Turn with me to Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. And we'll use our Bibles for a few minutes in these last few minutes this morning. You find this on page 1201 if you're using one of the church Bibles this morning. The conviction that God is a God who speaks to us. Look at these verses in Hebrews 1 and 2. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. Now look at verse 2. But in these last days, God has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. And I love the way Eugene Peterson puts that in the Message. Look at the screen behind me this morning. This is how he puts it in a slightly different form, slightly different language. It's just a little bit fresher because if you know these verses, this helps just to pull out the meaning. Going through a long line of prophets, God has been addressing our ancestors in different ways for centuries. Recently, he has spoken to us directly through his Son. By his Son, God created the world in the beginning and it will all belong to the Son at the end. The Son perfectly mirrors God. And he is stamped with God's nature. He holds everything together by what he says. Powerful words. That is our Christian conviction. That is what we believe as Christians this morning, that God is a God who speaks to us. He isn't a God who has entered into some kind of divine, cosmic hide-and-seek game or guessing game. He speaks to us through the Bible. He continues to speak to us today. Through his Son, Jesus Christ, who is described in these verses as the exact representation of his being. That is our conviction as Christian people. That is where our confidence needs to come from. Not a self-confidence, because it is God who has revealed himself to us. That's why God is referred to as the Word in the beginning of John's Gospel. God is a God who speaks to us. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 3. Here's the second Christian conviction that we hold dearly as Christian people. Turn to John chapter 14, verses 8 and 9. Because here you'll see Philip, one of the disciples, asking the same kind of question that people are asking today. God, if you're there, can you prove it? That's the sort of question that Philip is asking in this passage. It's a conversation that's been taking place between Jesus and the disciples. And it comes to verse 8 of chapter 14. And here's Philip, the guy who has so many questions. And eventually he says, Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough for us. If you're really God, God, if you're really there, then prove it. And it seems as you look at Jesus' reply in verse 9 that Jesus is surprised that Philip could even ask such a question. And he says in verse 9, he says, anyone who has seen me, Philip, has seen the Father. And Jesus is making a remarkable claim in this passage. He is claiming to be God, a claim that lies at the very heart of the Christian faith. He's saying both to us and to Philip, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. The guessing games are over. All the divine fingerprints that we've been looking at this morning are pointing us in the right direction. Paul writes to the Christian church in Rome. He says, people are without excuse. And as you read through the New Testament, we're told again and again by people who met Jesus that he was who he claimed to be. And he validates those claims through his death and through his resurrection. And John himself writes back in chapter 1, if you flick back to chapter 1 in verse 14. John says the words, Jesus Christ, chapter 1, verse 14, became flesh, and he made his dwelling among us. He says, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and full of truth. John says, we have seen this person. And the reason that John is writing his gospel, he makes it very clear towards the end of it. He says, we want you to understand that Jesus Christ is who he claimed to be. That's the second Christian conviction that we need to hold closely to in the argument for the existence of God. Third Christian conviction, that Jesus Christ acted as if he was God. Look at Matthew chapter 28 and verse 18. Remarkable claim about authority. Who else do you know has ever made a claim like this? Page 1001. Then Jesus came to his disciples, some of the last recorded words of Jesus. And he said to the disciples, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Do you know anyone else who has ever made a claim that comes close to that? And you know, as you look at the life of Jesus Christ, that authority is clear to see. He displayed an authority over sickness by healing people who came to him. He displayed his authority over nature by stilling a storm and walking across the water. He displayed his authority over evil by setting people free from evil spirits and spiritual darkness. He displayed his authority over death by raising people from the dead. He claimed to have an authority to be able to forgive sin. That was an authority which belonged only to God. He even predicted his own death and resurrection. And 3 days after his death, he rose again. And everywhere that Jesus went throughout his life, he applied the name of God to himself again and again and again. Everywhere he went, he acted as if he was God, claiming that if we have seen him, we have seen the Father, that through him, God has proved his existence to us beyond reasonable doubt. That however staggering the implications of Jesus' actions and words may be, he has proved to us that he is God. Christian convictions, things that we hold dearly too. And here's a Christian conviction that should really hit its mark with us this morning if you're a follower of Christ here today, that Jesus Christ makes it possible for us to encounter God today. Look at John chapter 1 and verse 18. If you're a follower of Christ this morning, this should be part of your story. John chapter 1 verse 18. John says, no one has seen God. The God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known. In other words, Jesus Christ has come into our world in a human form in a way that we can relate to. And if you look over to John chapter 7, there's a wonderful invitation that John writes in his Gospel. In verse 17 of chapter 7, he says, if anyone chooses to do God's will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. That's one of those invitations from Jesus to consider the facts. and to embrace those facts and to step out in faith. And many of you are here today because you've discovered that relationship with God. That's what's drawn us together this morning. We've encountered God through the person of Jesus Christ. I want to encourage you this morning by urging you not to hold back from the people that you rub shoulders with and tell them that you walk and talk regularly with a God who is there and can be known. I want to encourage you to invite people to this Food for Thought course. We're taking a risk this year. We're taking it out of this church building and we're taking it down into the town where people rub shoulders with. That's why we're doing it. I want you to consider inviting people because we're confident about what we believe as Christians. Not because we're self-confident, but because we believe that this is how God has revealed himself to us. We have no reason to cower when someone challenges us about our faith, because our faith is not based in shifting sand. It's not liable to collapse or to subside. And I hope that in some small way this morning, even as we've moved very quickly through some of these passages, and as we've looked at some of the reasons, some of those convictions that we have as Christians, that our faith has a strong and rational foundation. That these five clues that we've been looking at this morning are designed to lead us to Jesus Christ. That the Christian convictions that we hold to are not just things that we talk about, but they're things that are true. That God has spoken to us. That God continues to speak to us. That God wants to draw people to himself through faith in Jesus Christ. That Jesus is who he claimed to be. He came into the world with the authority of God. And through Jesus Christ, we can encounter him personally today. It may well be that some of you in church this morning, or perhaps some of you who are listening to this through our website, might describe yourselves as people are on the outside looking in. You're thinking about some of those divine fingerprints, thinking about some of those Christian convictions, but you're not really yet in that point where you've embraced the Christian faith. You've got lots of questions. Next time God prompts you in your thinking, as he will from time to time, why not say something like this to him? God, I know that you're real. Deep down, I have that sense that you do exist. But you're going to have to help me to understand that you are really there. Help me to accept this invitation from Jesus to find out whether or not this teaching comes from you or not. It doesn't make sense to me right now, but show it to me. Help me to understand it more. Or maybe if you describe yourself this morning on the outside looking in, why not come to this Food for Thought course? It's a great place to bring the questions. We love people bringing their questions to this course. That's what it's been designed for. So that you can bring your questions about the existence of God and who Jesus really is. So here are five divine fingerprints this morning. As I said, there are many, many more that we could have addressed this morning, but perhaps in some small way, as this book is launched in the coming week, and as the debate continues to develop, in some small way, as Christian people, we can engage in this debate in this coming week. We can point people to some of these divine fingerprints. We can engage in rational conversation with people. But we can also speak about our Christian convictions. This is what I believe as a Christian. This is what is real to me. This is what I have discovered as part of my spiritual journey. This is something that I want to share. So as you move out into a new week, we don't go out self-confident and arrogant. We go out gently. Gently pointing people to the person of Jesus Christ. Praying that God, by his Spirit, will use our conversations to draw people to himself. None of us can make people Christians. That is God's work. That is the role of God's Holy Spirit to do that.